Chapter 19. Proposals from Stockbridge and from the Commissioners. Visit to Stockbridge, Indian Mission, House Eight Nux, Mohawks, Dissensions of English Inhabitants, M.R. Hollis's Munificence. Early in December, 1750, Mr. Edwards received proposals from the church and congregation at Stockbridge to become their minister. And about the same time, similar proposals from the Commissioners, Ed Boston, of the Society in London, for propagating the gospel in New England and the parts adjacent, to become the missionary of the House Eight Nux, or River Indians, a tribe at that time located in Stockbridge and its immediate vicinity. Before deciding on these proposals, he went to Stockbridge in the beginning of January, 1751, and continued there during the remainder of the winter and the early part of the spring, preaching both to the English inhabitants and, by the aid of an interpreter, to the Indians. Soon after his return, he accepted of the invitation both of the commissioners and of the people of Stockbridge. The Indian mission at Stockbridge commenced in 1735, when the Revelation John Sargent was ordained their missionary. He continued to reside there until his death, July 27, 1749. His Indian congregation, originally about 50 in number, gradually increased, by accessions from the neighboring settlements on the Housatonic River, to the number of 250, the actual number in 1751. Mr. Sargent devoted much of his time to the study of their language, the Mohicanu. 39 yet, at the close of his life, he had not made such progress that he could preach in it, or even pray in it, except by a form. He ultimately regretted the time and labor thus lost, and expressed the conviction that it would be far better for his successor not to learn the language, but to preach by an interpreter, and to teach the children of the Indians the English language, by the aid of schoolmasters. Very little success appears to have attended his labors, either among the Indians or the English congregation. A school was established, for the instruction of the Indian children, at the commencement of the mission, and placed under the care of Timothy Woodbridge, Esquire, one of the original settlers of Stockbridge, and characterized by Mr. Edwards as a man of very good abilities, of a manly, honest, and generous disposition, and as having, by his upright conduct and agreeable manners, secured the affections and confidence of the Indians. He was supported by the government of the province, and devoted himself faithfully to the business of instructing the Indian children. Yet for a long period, like Mr. Sargent, he had to lament that so little success attended his labors. This was owing to various causes. The Indians lived in a village by themselves, at a small distance from the English settlement. Their children lived at home with their parents, and not in a boarding school, and of course made little or no progress in the English language. And they had no books in their own. The English traders sold large quantities of ardent spirits to the Indians, and in this way constantly counteracted the efforts made to do them good. There were also unfortunate dissensions among the people of Stockbridge. The settlement of the town was begun, with a direct reference to the intellectual and moral improvement of the Indians, in the immediate vicinity. The lands of the Indians, comprising a very extensive tract, were secured to them, and important privileges were granted to the families of the original settlers, by the provincial legislature, with reference to this very object. Unfortunately, one of the most wealthy of those settlers appears to have removed to Stockbridge, with the design of amassing a still larger fortune by his intercourse with the Indian settlement. With this view, he formed a large trading establishment in the neighborhood. From his wealth and his locality, affairs of some moment, relating to the Indians at Stockbridge, were on various occasions entrusted to his management. In one of which Mr. Woodbridge regarded him as doing so great and palpable an injury, both to the Indians and the province, that, taking it in connection with the general tenor of his conduct, he felt himself bound to prevent, as far as lay in his power, all intercourse between him and the Indian settlement, as well as all influence which he might attempt to exert over the affairs of the Indians. In return, he endeavored, in the first instance, to prevent the Indians from sending their children to the school, and to render those parents who actually sent them dissatisfied with Mr. Woodbridge, and at length to procure the dismission of that gentleman from his appointment. This controversy was of long continuance, and affected the whole settlement. The result was, that although he amassed considerable wealth, he entirely lost the confidence of the Indians, and so completely alienated the minds of the English inhabitants that every family in the place, his own excepted, sided with his antagonist. This controversy, for a long time, had a most inauspicious effect on the school of Mr. Woodbridge and on the mission of Mr. Sargent. In 1739, Mr. Sargent, despairing of any considerable success under the existing plan of instruction, attempted the establishment of an Indian boarding school, to be kept at the expense of the English. He proposed that the children should live in the family of their instructor, and learn the English language, and that their time should be divided between work and study, under different masters. For some time, he made but little progress in raising funds for this purpose, but at length was aided in his design by the benevolence of the Revelation Isaac Hollis, a clergyman near London, who most generously offered to defray the expense of the board, clothing, and instruction of 12 Indian children. At this time no boarding house was built, and for a long period, Mr. Sargent found it impossible to procure a person duly qualified to take charge of the school. To begin the work, however, Mr. Sargent hired as a temporary teacher, until a competent one could be procured, a Captain Martin Kellogg, an illiterate man, originally a farmer, and subsequently a soldier, about 60 years of age, very lame, and wholly unaccustomed to the business of instruction. His sister, Mrs. Ashley, the wife of a Captain Ashley, of Suffield, who had been taken prisoner, when a child, by the Iroquois, and perfectly understood their language, was the interpreter of the English at Stockbridge. And her brother, having come to reside there, in consequence of having no regular business, was employed temporarily by Mr. Sargent, for the want of a better instructor, because he was on the spot. A school had just been commenced under his auspices, not however as a boarding school, as no house could be procured for the purpose, when the French War of 1744 broke it up. And Captain Kellogg, that he might continue to receive the money of Mr. Hollis, carried several of the Indian boys to Newington, in Connecticut, where he had previously resided. After the close of the war, in 1748, Mr. Sargent began the erection of a house for a boarding school. He also wrote a letter to the nation of the Mohawks, then residing on the Mohawk River, about 40 miles west of Albany, inviting them to bring their children to Stockbridge for instruction. But he did not live to see either of these designs accomplished. At his death, in 1749, several Indian boys were left in the hands of Captain Kellogg, who in the autumn of 1750, not having heard from M.R. Hollis for a considerable period, and supposing him to be dead, dismissed them for a time, and gave up his attempt to form a school. In consequence of the letter of Mr. Sargent to the Mohawk tribe, which had been accompanied by a very kind invitation from the Housatonuck Indians, offering them a portion of their lands for a place of settlement, if they would come and reside in Stockbridge, about 20 of them, old and young, came to that place in 1750, a short time before the removal of Mr. Edwards and his family. The provincial legislature, learning this fact, made provision for the support and maintenance of the children, and Cap Kellogg, unfortunately, was employed as the instructor. He never established a regular school, however, but taught the boys occasionally, and incidentally, and employed them chiefly in cultivating his own lands. He was then 65 years of age. Near the close of Mr. Sargent's life, the school for the Housatonuck children, under Mr. Woodbridge, became much more flourishing. His salary was increased, the number of his pupils augmented, and himself left to act with less restraint. The Indians also became less inclined to intemperance. The influence of the family was likewise extinct. The English inhabitants having to a man taken the opposite side in the controversy, and the Indians regarding Mr. Woodbridge as their best friend, and his opponent as their worst enemy. Mr. Woodbridge was also, at this period, able to avail himself of the assistance of a young Housatonuck, educated by himself, of the name of John Wanwanonpukanot, a man of uncommon talents and attainments, as well as of sincere piety, who appears to have been raised up by Providence, that he might become the interpreter of Mr. Edwards, in preaching to his countrymen. Mr. Hollis, having heard of the arrival of the Mohawks at Stockbridge, and supposing that a regular boarding school was established under the care of Captain Kellogg, wrote to him to increase the number of the children to 24, who were to be maintained and instructed at his expense. During the winter of 1750-51, the number of Mohawks who came to reside at Stockbridge was increased to about 90, among whom were Hendrick and Nicholas, and seven others of their chiefs. Such was the state of things at Stockbridge, and such the state of the Indian mission and of the Indian schools, when Mr. Edwards was invited to remove to that place. The family at first exerted their whole influence to prevent his receiving an invitation from the people at Stockbridge. But, finding that the church and parish themselves accepted were unanimous in giving the invitation, and very anxious that he should accept it, that there was no chance of producing a change in the minds of the commissioners in Boston, and that continued opposition must terminate in their own utter discomfiture, they changed their course, and professed to be highly gratified that he was coming among them. After his return to Northampton, in the spring of 1751, Mr. Edwards, before coming to a final decision, paid a visit to His Excellency Sir William Pepperell, at Kittery, to learn the actual views of the government with regard to the Indian establishment at Stockbridge. And having received satisfactory assurances on this subject, he soon after announced to the people of Stockbridge, and to the commissioners in Boston, his acceptance of their respective invitations. In the third week of June, he went again to Stockbridge, and remained there during the greater part of the ensuing month. While at Stockbridge, he addressed the following letter to the Revelation M.R. Erskine. Stockbridge, June 28, 1751. Rev. and dear brother, I have lately received the treatise on the restoration of the Jews, and a pamphlet entitled, A Serious Address to the Church of Scotland, and a sermon on the qualifications of the teachers of Christianity, preached by you before the Synod, with Glass's notes on scripture texts, number 5. These pamphlets were enclosed in a wrapper, superscribed by your hand. There was also in the packet, a brief advertisement concerning one of the pamphlets, written in your hand, though without any date or name, or any letter in the packet. But yet, I conclude these pamphlets were sent by you, and accordingly I now thank you for them. Your discourse on the qualifications of teachers of Christianity is a very acceptable present. Glass's notes on scripture texts contain some things that are very curious, and discover close study and a critical genius. The treatise on the restoration of the Jews, if written by a Christian divine, is a strange and unaccountable thing. By reason of there being nothing at all said, or hinted, about the Jews' conversion to the Christian faith, or so much as one mention of Jesus Christ, and his supporting that the prophecies of Ezekiel are to be literally fulfilled, in the building of such a temple and city as is there described, and the springing of such a river from the threshold of the temple, and its running into the East Sea, and the Jews offering sacrifices, and observing other rites spoken of in Ezekiel. And that the Messiah is yet to come, and to reign in Jerusalem as a temple prince, etc., and I am wholly at a loss, as to the author's real design, whether it was, to promote Judaism, or deism, or only to amuse his readers. Since I received these pamphlets, I have received letters from all my other correspondents in Scotland, but none from you. Mr. Mlerin speaks of your writing, or designing to write, but suggests that possibly your letter would not arrive so soon as the rest, so that I hope I shall yet, ere long, receive a letter from you. The letters I have received from my other correspondents make mention of a great revival of religion in Gilderland, and Mr. Mlerin has sent me printed accounts of it, published, as I understand, by Mr. Gillies, his son-in-law, being extracts of letters from Holland. I had some notice of it before, in a letter from Mr. Davenport, who, for the most part, resides in New Jersey. The account he wrote was brought over from Holland by a young Dutch minister, whose name is John Frelinghuysen, born in New Jersey, second son to an eminent Dutch minister there. His elder brother is settled at Albany, and by all accounts, is an able and faithful minister. This second son has been in Holland 2 years, I suppose to perfect his education in one of their universities, where his brother at Albany had his education. He came over into America the last summer, having just been married and ordained in Holland, in order to take the pastoral charge of some of the places that had been under his father's care. The accounts Mr. Davenport gives from him are not so particular as those that are published by Mr. Gillies. But there is one material and important circumstance which he mentions, not taken notice of in the accounts from Scotland, namely, that the Stadtholder was much pleased with the work. At the same time, that we rejoice in that glorious work, and praise God for it, it concerns us carefully to pray, that God's ministers and people there may be directed in such a state of things, wherein wisdom and great discretion are so exceedingly needed, and great care and skill, to distinguish between true and false religion. Between those inward experiences, which are from the saving influence of the Spirit of God, and those that are from Satan, transforming himself into an angel of light. Without this, it may be expected that the great deceiver will gradually insinuate himself. Acting under disguise, he will pretend to be a zealous assistant in building the temple, yea, the chief architect, when his real design will be to bring all to the ground, and to build Babel, instead of the temple of God, finally to the great reproach and grief of all true friends of religion, and the hearty triumph of its adversaries. If I may be allowed my conjecture in this affair, there lies the greatest danger of the people in Gelderland, who are concerned in this work. I wish they had all the benefit of the late experience of this part of the Church of God, here in America. Mr. Mlerin informs me, dear sir, that you have a correspondence in the Netherlands. And, as you know something of the calamities we have suffered from this quarter, I wish you would give them some kind admonitions. They will need all the warnings that can be given them. For the temptation to religious people, in such a state of things, to countenance the glaring, shining counterparts of religion, without distinguishing them from the reality, what is true and genuine, is so strong, that they are very hardly indeed restrained from it. They will at last find the consequences not to be good, of an abundant declaring and proclaiming their experience, on all occasions, and before all companies, if they get into that way, as they will be very likely to do, without special caution in their guides. I am not so much concerned about any danger. The interest of the revival of religion in Gelderland may be in, from violent open opposition, as from the secret, subtle, undiscerned guile of the old serpent. I perceive, pious ministers in the Netherlands are concerned to obtain attestations to the good abiding effect of the awakenings in Scotland and America. I think it is fit they should know the very truth of the case, and that things should be represented neither better nor worse than they are. If they should be represented worse, that would give encouragement to unreasonable opposers. If better, that might prevent a most necessary caution of the true friends of the awakening. There are, undoubtedly, very many instances in New England, in the whole, of the perseverance of such as were thought to have received the saving benefits of the late revival of religion, and of their continuing to walk in newness of life, and as become saints. Instances, which are incontestable, and which men must be most obstinately blind not to see. But I believe the proportion here is not so great as in Scotland. I cannot say that the greater part of supposed converts give reason, by their conversation, to suppose that they are true converts. The proportion may, perhaps, be more truly represented by the proportion of the blossoms on a tree which abide and come to mature fruit, to the whole number of blossoms in the spring. In the forementioned letter, which I lately received from Mr. Davenport, he mentions some degrees of awakening in some places of New Jersey. The following are extracts from his letter. I returned last month from Cape May, where I had been laboring some time, with little or no success, as to the unregenerate. Except somewhat encouraging, the last day of my preaching among them. Yet, blessed be God, I hear of the success of several ministers in the Jerseys, and the revival of religion in some places. Though it is very dull times in most. Mr. Rita Boundbrook has, I hear, some encouragement, by reason of a few in that place being under conviction. M.R. Kennedy, who is likely to settle at Baskingridge, I hear, has still more encouragement. And Mr. John Frelinghuysen more yet, among the Dutch. He is the second son of the Mr. Frelinghuysen, mentioned in your narrative, who died a few years ago. This second son came over from Holland, where he had been 2 years, and was ordained a little before he came over, the last summer. Pious ministers among the Dutch, this way, I think increase faster of late than among other people. I was at the house of such an one, M.R. Varbrick, as I came along in this journey, who was ordained last fall, about 5 miles beyond Dobbs's Ferry, in New York government. Mr. William Tennant told me that Mr. John Light, a pious young Dutch minister in New Jersey, was translating the accounts from Holland into English. Mr. Brainerd has had some special success lately, through mercy. So that 9 or 10 Indians appear to be under conviction, as he tells me. And about 12 of the white people near them, that used to be stupid like the very heathen. And many others more thoughtful and serious. Mr. Sackett has lately been favored with peculiar success, in reducing a number drawn away and infected by the separatists. And some endeavors I have used since that, and with him, have, I trust, not been altogether in vain. The good Lord grant that false religion may cease, and true religion prevail through the earth. This letter of Mr. Davenport was dated April 26, 1751. The Dutch people in the provinces of New York and New Jersey have been famed for being generally exceedingly ignorant, stupid, and profane, little better than the savages of our American deserts. But it is remarkable that things should now begin to appear more hopeful among them, about the same time that religion is reviving among the Dutch in their mother country. And certainly the revivals of religion which have very lately appeared, especially among the Dutch in Europe, do verify God's holy word, which not only gives such great encouragement to those who have engaged in the Concert for United Prayer, begun in Scotland, to go forward, but binds it strongly upon them so to do. And shows that it will be an aggravated fault, if, after God does such glorious things so soon after we have begun in an extraordinary manner to ask them, we should grow cold and slack, and begin to faint. And I think what God has now done, may well cause those, who seemed at first, with some zeal, to engage in the affair, but have grown careless about it, and have left off, to reflect on themselves with blushing and confusion. What if you, dear sir, and other ministers in Scotland, who have been engaged in this affair, should now take occasion to inform ministers in the Netherlands of it, and move them to come into it, and join with us, in our united and extraordinary prayers, for an universal revival of religion. As to my present circumstances, I came the last week to this place, having undertaken the business of a missionary to the Indians here. Having been chosen the pastor of this church, and chosen missionary by the commissioners for Indian affairs in Boston. My installment is appointed to be on the second Thursday in the next month. 40 I don't expect to get ready to remove my family till winter. But I must refer you, dear sir, to my letters to M. Armlerin and Mr. Robe, for a more full account of my circumstances, and of the things which have passed relating to them. I have, with this, sent you the Gazette, containing the result of the late council at Northampton, and intend to order one of my farewell sermons to be put up for you. My family were in their usual state of health when I left them, excepting my youngest child, who had something like an intermittent fever. Please to present my cordial respects, and Christian love, to your dear consort, and remember me in your prayers, with regard to the trials and changes I am called to pass through, and the new important business I have undertaken. I am, dear sir, your most united and obliged friend and brother, Jonathan Edwards. From Mr. Gillespie he received, about this period, a letter most grateful to his own feelings, expressing a lively and affectionate sympathy in his afflictions, as well as surprise and astonishment at the conduct of the people of Northampton. Mr. Edwards, in his reply, communicates a series of facts respecting them, which not only were adapted at the time to remove these impressions of his friend, but will be found, also, to contain a most important and salutary lesson of instruction to every minister and every church. The solemn caution of the Apostle, in 1 Corinthians 3:10-15, to every minister, to take care how he builds up the temple of God, of which Jesus Christ is the foundation, a caution which refers not only to the nature of the doctrines which he teaches, but also, and even more especially, as will be obvious from verses 16 and 17, to the character of the members whom he adds to the Church of Christ, which is the temple of God, is here enforced most solemnly, by arguments derived from experience. To the Revelation Thomas Gillespie, Carnac, Stockbridge, July 1, 1751. Rev. and Very Dear Sir, I am very greatly obliged to you for your most kind, affectionate, comfortable, and profitable letter of February 2, 1751. I thank you, dear sir, for your sympathy with me, under my troubles, so amply testified, and the many suitable and proper considerations you suggest me, for my comfort and improvement. May God enable me to make a right improvement of them. It is not to be wondered at, dear sir, that you are shocked and surprised at what has happened between me and the people of Northampton. It is surprising to all impartial and considerate persons that live near, and have the greatest advantage to know the circumstances of the affair, and the things that preceded the event, and made way for it. But no wonder if it be much more so to strangers at a distance. I doubt not, but that God intends his own glory, and the safety and prosperity of Zion, and the advancement of the interests of religion, in the issue of this event. But it is best, that the true state of the case should be known, and that it should be viewed as it is, in order to receiving that instruction which divine providence holds forth in it, and in order to proper reflections and right improvement. As there is a difference among particular persons, as to their natural temper, so there is some difference of this kind to be observed in different countries, and also in different cities and towns. The people of Northampton have, ever since I can remember, been famed for a high-spirited people, and of a difficult and turbulent temper. However, though in some respects they have been a stiff-necked people, yet God has been pleased, in times past, to bestow many distinguishing favors upon them. The town has stood now near 100 years. Their first minister, Mr. Eleazar Mather, brother to Drive Increase Mather of Boston, and Mr. Samuel Mather of Dublin, Ireland, was a very eminent man of God. After him came Mr. Stoddard, my grandfather, a very great man, of strong powers of mind, of great grace and great authority, of a masterly countenance, speech, and behavior. He had much success in his ministry. There being many seasons in this day, of general awakening among his people. He continued in the ministry, at Northampton, about 60 years. But God was pleased, in some respects, especially, to manifest his power in the weakness of his successor. There having been a more remarkable awakening, since his death, than ever had been till then, in that town, although since that, also, a greater declension, and more awful departures from God, in some respects, than ever before. And so the last minister has had more to humble him, than either of his predecessors. May the effect be answerable to God's just expectations. The people have, from the beginning, been well instructed. Having had a name, for a long time, for a very knowing people. And many have appeared among them, persons of good abilities. And many, born in the town, have been promoted to places of public trust. They have been a people distinguished on this account. These things have been manifestly abused to nourish the pride of their natural temper, which had made them more difficult and unmanageable. There were some mighty contests and controversies among them, in Mr. Stoddard's day, which were managed with great heat and violence, some great quarrels in the church, wherein Mr. Stoddard, great as his authority was, knew not what to do with them. In one ecclesiastical controversy in M.R. Stoddard's day, wherein the church was divided into two parties, the heat of spirit was raised to such a degree, that it came to hard blows. A member of one party met the head of the opposite party, and assaulted him, and beat him unmercifully. In latter times, the people have had more to feed their pride. They have grown a much greater and more wealthy people than formerly, and are become more extensively famous in the world, as a people that have excelled in gifts and grace, and had God extraordinarily among them, which has insensibly engendered and nourished spiritual pride, that grand and led of the devil in the hearts of men, an avenue of all manner of mischief among a professing people. Spiritual pride is a most monstrous thing. If it be not discerned, and vigorously opposed, in the beginning, it very often soon raises persons above their teachers, and supposed spiritual fathers, and sets them out of the reach of all rule and instruction, as I have seen in innumerable instances. And there is this inconvenience, attending the publishing of narratives of a work of God among a people, such is the corruption that is in the hearts of men, and even of good men, that there is great danger of their making it an occasion of spiritual pride. There is great reason to think that the Northampton people have provoked God greatly against them, by trusting in their privileges and attainments. And the consequences may well be a warning to all God's people, far and near, that hear of them. Another thing, which probably has contributed in some measure to the unhappiness of the people's manners, was that Mr. Stoddard, though an eminently holy man, was naturally of a dogmatical temper. And the people being brought up under him, and with a high veneration for him, were naturally led to imitate him. Especially their officers and leading men seemed to think it an excellency to be like him in this respect. It has been a very great wound to the Church of Northampton that there has been for 40 or 50 years a sort of settled division of the people into two parties, somewhat like the court and country party in England, if I may compare small things with great. There have been some of the chief men in the town, of chief authority and wealth, that have been great proprietors of their lands, who have had one party with them, and the other party, which has commonly been the greatest, have been of those who have been jealous of them, apt to envy them, and afraid of their having too much power and influence in town and church. This has been a foundation of innumerable contentions among the people, from time to time, which have been exceedingly grievous to me, and by which doubtless God has been dreadfully provoked, and his spirit grieved and quenched, and much confusion and many evil works have been introduced. Another thing that evidently has contributed to our calamities is that the people had got so established in certain wrong notions and ways in religion, which I found them in, and could never beat them out of. Particularly, it was too much their method to lay almost all the stress of their hopes in religion on the particular shape and method of their first work. 1e. The first work of the Spirit of God on their hearts, in their conviction and conversion. And to look but little at the abiding sense and temper of their hearts, and the course of their exercises, and trials of grace, for evidences of their good estate. Nor have they learned, and many of them never could be made to learn, to distinguish between impressions on the imagination, and lively spiritual experience. And when I came among them, I found it to be too much a custom among them without discretion, or distinction of occasions, places, or companies, to declare and publish their own experiences, and oftentimes to do it in a light manner, without any air of solemnity. This custom has not a little contributed to spiritual pride and many other evils. When I first settled among the people, being young and of little experience, I was not thoroughly aware of the ill consequences of such a custom, and so allowed or at least did not testify against it, as I ought to have done. And here I desire it may be observed that I would be far from so laying all the blame of the sorrowful things that have come to pass to the people, as to suppose that I have no cause of self-reflection and humiliation before God on this occasion. I am sensible that it becomes me to look on what has lately happened as an awful frown of heaven on me, as well as on the people. God knows the sinfulness of my heart, and the great and sinful deficiencies and offenses which I have been guilty of in the course of my ministry at Northampton. I desire that God would discover them to me more and more, and that now he would effectually humble me, and mortify my pride and self-confidence, and empty me entirely of myself, and make me to know how that I deserve to be cast away, as an abominable branch, and as a vessel wherein is no pleasure. And, if it may consist with his holy will, that he would sanctify me, and make me a vessel more meet for my master's use, and yet improve me as an instrument of his glory, and the good of the souls of mankind. One thing that has contributed to bring things to such a pass at Northampton was my youth, and want of more judgment and experience, in the time of that extraordinary awakening, about 16 years ago. 41 instead of a youth, there was want of a giant, in judgment and discretion, among a people in such an extraordinary state of things. In some respects, doubtless, my confidence in myself was a great injury to me. But in other respects my diffidence of myself injured me. It was such that I durst not act my own judgment, and had no strength to oppose received notions and established customs, and to testify boldly against some glaring false appearances and counterfeits of religion, till it was too late. And by this means, as well as others, many things got footing, which have proved a dreadful source of spiritual pride, and other things that are exceedingly contrary to true Christianity. If I had had more experience, and ripeness of judgment and courage, I should have guided my people in a better manner, and should have guarded them better from Satan's devices, and prevented the spiritual calamity of many souls, and perhaps the eternal ruin of some of them. and have done what would have tended to lengthen out the tranquility of the town. However, doubtless at that time, there was a very glorious work of God wrought in Northampton, and there were numerous instances of saving conversion. Though undoubtedly many were deceived, and deceived others. And the number of true converts was not so great as was then imagined. Many may be ready, from things that are lately come to pass, to determine that all Northampton religion is come to nothing, and that all the famed awakenings and revivals of religion in that place prove to be nothing but strange tides of a melancholy and whimsical humor. But they would draw no such conclusion if they exactly knew the true state of the case, and would judge of it with full calmness and impartiality of mind. There are many things to be considered in the case of Northampton. 1. That many of those who have been most violently engaged, and have chiefly led and excited others in it, though they have been leading men in the town, and have been esteemed considerable for their knowledge, estate, and age, and have been professors of religion, yet have not been the most famed for piety. 2. The leading men, who have been the most engaged in this matter, who have taken vast pains to stir up others that are inferior, have had this great advantage in their hands, that the controversy was a religious controversy. That which I opposed, was what they always had supposed to be a part of divine truth, a precious and important doctrine of the Word of God. And that the cause of my opposers was the cause of God. This has led the more ignorant and less considerate people to look on their zeal against me as virtue, and to christen even their passions and bitterness in such a cause with sanctified names, and to let them loose, and prosecute the views of their bitterness and violence without a check of conscience. 3. They have also had the great advantage of the vast veneration the people had for Mr. Stoddard's memory, which was such that many looked on him almost as a sort of deity. They were all, that is, except the young people, born and brought up under his ministry, and had been used from their infancy to esteem his sayings all as oracles. And he, they knew, maintained that doctrine which I oppose, with great positiveness and zeal, and opposed the contrary, which I maintain, as an exceedingly pernicious doctrine. Under these circumstances, I naturally appear as a dangerous opposer of the cause of God, and my teaching and insisting on the doctrine, which Mr. Stoddard opposed, appears to them a sort of horrid profaneness. 4. Crafty designing men have abundantly filled the ears of the more ignorant with suggestions, that my opinion tends to overthrow all religion, and to ruin the present and future generations, and to make all heathens, shutting them out of the Church of Christ. 5. Not only many of the leading men of Northampton have used their utmost endeavors to engage the minds of the common people in this controversy, but they have also been put forward by the neighboring ministers all round. My opposers have also been assisted and edged on by some at a great distance, persons of note. And some great men in civil authority have had a great hand in it. 6. It is to be considered that the contrary opinion to mine had not only long been established in Northampton without so much as one opposer to it, but it had also been fully and quietly established, for a long time, in all the neighboring churches and congregations, and in all the country round, even to a great distance. So that my opinion, when first broached, appeared to the people exceedingly singular. Their views being very narrow, it appeared to them that all the world, almost, was against me. And my most crafty opposers improved this advantage, and abundantly represented me as all alone in my opinion. 7. Many of the people, who at length came to have their spirits much raised, and were brought to join in violent measures, yet came slowly into it, after being long practiced with, and indefatigable endeavors used, to engage and influence them. 8. There are about 20 heads of families, besides others, women and young people, who ever appeared openly against the proceedings of the town, and many others have appeared friendly to me. And there is not a little reason to think that there are many more, especially women and youths, that would appear so, if they dare. For a person, by appearing my friend at Northampton, even so much so as openly to discountenance my being turned out of the pulpit, exposes himself to the immediate persecution of his neighbors, and perhaps of his nearest friends. I mean, he falls under their great resentment, loses all their friendship, and is everywhere the object of reproach. 9. It is to be considered that these things have happened when God is greatly withdrawn, and religion was very low, not only at Northampton, but all over New England. 10. I believe the devil is greatly alarmed by the opposition made to the lax doctrine of admission to the Christian Church, and to the corresponding practice, which had been so long established at Northampton, and so extensively in the country, in which he found his account, and hoped for more important consequences, and more agreeable to him. And God, for wise ends, has suffered him to exert himself, in an extraordinary manner, in opposition, as God ordinarily does, when truth is in the birth. But I am drawn out to an unexpected length in my observations on these things, and have not left myself room, nor time, for some other things, that I would willingly write, and must therefore refer you to my letters to my other correspondents in Scotland, particularly M. R. Laurin, Mr. Robe, M. R. McCulloch, and Mr. Erskine. To some of them, I have sent a particular account of my present circumstances, and of things which have lately passed, relating to them. I would only say in general, that I have had a call to settle in Stockbridge, a place in the western borders of New England, next to the province of New York, about 36 miles from Albany, and about 40 miles from Northampton, the place where Mr. Sargent was minister and missionary to the Indians. I am both called by the church here, constituted partly of Indians and partly of English, and am appointed missionary to the Indians by the Commissioners of Indian Affairs in Boston. Agreeably to what you suggest in your letter, as though you had been able to foresee future events, when you say, perhaps you are to be employed where the gospel has been little understood or attended to. I suppose this place will, for the future, be the place of my ordinary abode, though it will be some months before I can remove my family. I have no leisure, at present, to write on the subject you speak of, namely, impressions, and supposed immediate revelations, though I own the vast importance of the subject. I had begun to write something against the Armenians, before the late controversy. And now lately, Mr. Williams has written a book, in answer to mine on that subject, which I think myself obliged to answer, if God give me opportunity. I have much to teach me to behave like a pilgrim and stranger in the earth. But in the midst of troubles and difficulties, I receive many mercies. Particularly, I have great reason, with abundant thankfulness, to take notice of the great kindness of my friends in Scotland. Blessed be God, who never forsakes those that trust in Him, and never wants instruments for the conveyance of His goodness and liberality to those who suffer in His cause. I shall take care that there be conveyed, with this letter, to you, one of my farewell sermons, and the result of the council that sat at Northampton the last May. Remember me, dear sir, at the throne of grace, with regard to all my trials, and with regard to my new circumstances, and the important service I have undertaken in this place. And please, in your next, to inform me what family you have, and of their state. I am, dear sir, your most affectionate friend and brother, Jonathan Edwards. The following letter of Mr. Edwards to the Revelation Isaac Hollis, the patron of one of the Indian schools at Stockbridge, will explain some of the difficulties to which they were subjected. To Mr. Hollis, Stockbridge, July 2, 1751. Rev. and Honored Sir, having seen your late letter to Mr. Prince of Boston, and another to Cap Kellogg, received this summer, and having lately been appointed missionary to the Indians in this place, I thought myself obliged to take the first opportunity to write to you, who have exerted yourself, in so extraordinary a manner, to promote our interests here, to serve which I am now devoted, partly to offer you my thanks for what you have done, and have lately offered to do, with so fervent and enlarged a heart, and bountiful a hand, for the advancement and enlargement of Christ's kingdom of grace among this poor people, and the eternal welfare of their souls, which may well excite the joy and admiration of all good Christians, the thanks of all who make the interests of Zion their own, and especially of him who has the souls of the Indians committed to his own more immediate care. I write, also, partly to inform you of what I have had opportunity to observe, of the state of things here, relating to the affair of the instruction of the Indians, which you have a right to know. It being an affair in which you have been pleased so greatly to interest yourself, and which depends so much on the effects of your most generous Christian beneficence. I have had considerable opportunity to observe the state of things. For though it is but about a month since I came here, after I had undertaken the work of the ministry here, as the stated missionary, yet I had been here before, 2 months in the winter, and then spent much time with the Indians, particularly with the Mohawks under the care of Cap Kellogg. There are here 2 schools for the instruction of Indian children, one under the care of Mr. Timothy Woodbridge, which began soon after Mr. Sargent began to preach to these Indians. The school consists wholly of the proper Housatonic Indians. The other, under the care of Captain Kellogg, which he began with the Housatonics, on the plan which Mr. Sargent projected. But, in the changeable unsettled state, in which things have been since M.R. Sargent's death, it has been altered from that form, and the Housatonic boys have left it, and it now consists wholly of Mohawk children, which have been brought down hither by their parents, from their own proper country, about 80 miles, to this end, that they might be taught to read, and write, and be instructed in the Christian religion. There are some things, which give a hopeful prospect with regard to these Mohawk Indians, particularly the forward inclination of the children and their aptness to learn. But that, which has evidently been the greatest defect from the beginning in the method of instruction here, is, that no more proper and effectual measures have been taken, to bring the children that are here to the knowledge of the English tongue. For want of this, all the labor and cost, which have been expended in schools here, for about 14 years, have been consequently to but little effect or benefit. When the children are taught to read, many of them, for want of the English language, know nothing of what they read, their books being all in English. They merely learn to make such and such sounds, on the sight of such and such marks, but know not the meaning of the words, and so have neither profit nor pleasure in reading, and will therefore be apt soon to lose even what they have learned, having no benefit or entertainment in the use of it. It is on many other accounts of great importance that they should be brought to know the English language. This would greatly tend to forward their instruction. Their own barbarous languages being exceedingly barren, and very unfit to express moral and divine things, it would likewise open their minds, and, by means of their acquaintance and conversation with the English, would tend to advance them in knowledge and civilization. Some pains has been taken to teach the children the English tongue, but nothing very considerable has been accomplished. And I can think of but 2 ways in which it can be effected, either by introducing a number of English children into the schools, to learn with them, and be their mates, or by distributing the Indian children into English families, to live there a year or two, where they must be allowed to speak the English and nothing else, and then return into the Indian schools, to perfect them in reading and writing, and the knowledge of the principles of religion, and all other useful knowledge. The latter, if their parents can be persuaded to consent to it, as probably they may, will be much the most effectual. I would therefore, sir, humbly propose, that some such method should be taken with regard to the children, who have the benefit of your liberality. And that part of your benefaction should be expended in this way, under the care of prudent and faithful trustees. For, in order to the business being managed thoroughly in future, a great deal of care and activity will be necessary, vastly more than the schoolmaster can have leisure for. There are many things pertaining to the regulation of the affairs of the instruction of the Indian children, which seem greatly to require the care of a number of persons, who shall be entrusted to dispose things according to the best of their discretion, sending from time to time a particular and exact account of the manner in which they have laid out your money. I thought myself obliged to give you these intimations, you being at a great distance, and not capable of knowing the exact state of things, any otherwise, than by the information of those who are on the spot. And it being fit that you should know those circumstances, which are of so much importance to the affair, that, without a proper regard to them, the great expense which you incur, is liable to be in a great measure in vain. I humbly request your prayers to the Fountain of all light and grace, for his guidance and assistance in this important service, which I have lately undertaken in this place. I am, honored sir, your most humble servant, an affectionate brother in the gospel ministry, Jonathan Edwards. A conference was appointed to be held at Albany, the last week in June, 1751, between the commissioners of the governments of Massachusetts, Connecticut, and New York, and the chiefs of the Iroquois, or Six Nations, for the purpose of making a treaty. The commissioners of Massachusetts were directed to pass through Stockbridge, on their way to Albany, for the purpose of conferring with the Mohawks already there, about their settlement in New England. On their arrival they found that Hendrick, and almost all the heads of families, on account of their disgust at the neglect of their children, on the part of Captain Kellogg, had returned to their own country. In consequence of this, they requested Mr. Edwards to go to Albany, and be present at the conference. Whither he accordingly went the first week in July. In an interview with Hendrick and Nicholas, he endeavored to persuade them to influence as many of the Mohawk chiefs as possible to go to Stockbridge, and their treat of their removal to New England. This being urged upon them afterwards, by the commissioners of Massachusetts, was agreed to by them and the other chiefs. And a conference appointed to be held at Stockbridge in August. Mr. Edwards then returned to Stockbridge, and in the latter part of July, to his family in Northampton. The first week in August, he removed his family and effects from Northampton to Stockbridge. And on Thursday, August 8, was regularly installed as the minister of the congregation in that place, and inducted into the office of missionary to the Indians residing in its vicinity. His salary was derived from three sources: from the parish of Stockbridge, from the society in London, for propagating the gospel in New England, and the parts adjacent, whose missionary he was, through their commissioners at Boston, and from the legislature of the colony, as a part of the annual fund devoted to the civilization of the Indians. This latter sum was paid, of course, to the individual who held the office of minister and missionary at Stockbridge, although the government had no voice in his appointment. On Tuesday, August 13th, the chiefs of the Mohawks came from their two principal settlements to Stockbridge, and met the commissioners of the province. The chiefs expressed a very strong desire that their children might be instructed, but objected to the removal to Stockbridge, on the ground that the affairs of the Mohawks there were left in the utmost confusion, that no regular school was established, and no thorough means taken for the education of their children. After reminding the commissioners how often the English had failed to fulfill their promises, and disappointed the hopes which they had encouraged them to entertain, they requested them to promise nothing but what the government would certainly perform. The commissioners agreed among themselves that in consequence of the utter incompetency of Captain Kellogg, another instructor, a man of learning and skill, must be procured for the Mohawk school, and promised the chiefs that a regular school should be established for their children, and a competent instructor speedily procured. After this, the chiefs declared their acceptance of the proposals made to them, of sending their children to Stockbridge for instruction, and of coming, a number of them, to reside there, and tendered a belt of wampum to the commissioners, in confirmation of the agreement, which was accepted. On Thursday, August 22nd, the council was dissolved, and the chiefs went home. The Mohawks at this time discovered a very strong desire to promote the education of their children, and an unusual willingness to receive religious instruction. As did also a part of the tribe of the Oneidas, or Oneidas, residing at Onohaquaga, or Onoquaga, a settlement on the Susquehanna. The French, having been apprised of the efforts making by the English, in behalf of the Mohawks, were busily occupied in seducing them, and the other tribes of the Iroquois, to emigrate into Canada, and were actually erecting a chain of forts extending from Canada through New York, Pennsylvania, and the wilderness beyond to the Mississippi. Mr. Edwards, believing that if the utmost good faith was not kept with the Mohawks the whole plan of instructing them would be defeated, and regarding the period as a most critical one for the welfare of the British colonies, addressed a letter on the subject of the Indians to the Honorable Thomas Hubbard, Speaker of the House of Assembly. In this letter he gave an account of the council held with the chiefs of the Mohawks at Stockbridge, and their agreement to encourage the education of their children at that place. Mentioned the interest felt in the subject by the Mohawks and the Oneidas, and by some of the Tuscaroras. Stated the vast importance of the existing crisis for securing the friendship of the Six Nations. Recited the machinations of the French to seduce them from the English interest, and their hostile movements in the West. pointed out the religious and literary instruction of the Indians as the only means of securing their attachment to the British cause, and detailed the measures necessary to be pursued at Stockbridge to promote these great objects. 42. When Mr. Edwards had removed his family to Stockbridge, he found himself exceedingly embarrassed from the difficulty of procuring the land necessary for his own immediate accommodation. When the town was first settled, it was granted to the house 8 nooks, except 6 portions, to the late missionary, the schoolmaster, and 4 other settlers. These portions were now distributed among 14 proprietors, and could be purchased only at a very high price. He therefore presented a petition to the General Court, at their session in October, 1751, asking leave to purchase the necessary lands, for his own accommodation, a homestead in the center of the town, and a piece of woodland in the outskirts. The legislature granted him leave to purchase the homesteads, and recommended to the English inhabitants to provide the necessary woodland for their minister. On the tract of land, which he purchased, near the center of the town, M.R. Edwards, soon after, erected a commodious dwelling, which is still standing,